Welcome to Smart in the City, the Babbel podcast. I am your host, Tamlin Shimizu, and really at Babbel, we aim to connect the players in the smart city industry with high quality information and ideas through our platform and services. This podcast is really an extension of this goal and mission to drive the change for a better urban life. First, a quick announcement from Babbel. We are delighted to announce a new interactive online training course, Smarter Connected Places, Experiential Learning for Tomorrow's Urban Leaders. You can find the link for more information and how to register in the show notes. Make sure to register by the 14th of October for an early bird discount. Now on to our regular programming. So yeah, we are visiting a new country on the podcast today, Austria, and specifically Innsbruck, Austria. And you probably know it for a bunch of skiing possibilities and the beautiful scenery. But I guess the real question that we'll be answering today are what are the actions the city is taking in things like citizen participation and more. So we are sitting here in the beautiful city of Helsingborg, Sweden, for the Urban Future Conference. And I got lucky enough to sit down with Elisabeth Meitze, who is the head of citizen participation at the city of Innsbruck. Welcome, Elisabeth. Glad to have you on.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks also for taking a long journey. We were just talking before this that you took a 18-hour train ride to get here. So applause on that for taking the sustainable way, less convenient, I'm sure.
I had some time to read a book.
Yeah.
Working, and I made some very nice contacts with people.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I also much prefer train travel over plane travel. And of course, it's a nicer way to do it. So yeah, thanks for being with us today. And so are you enjoying the conference so far?
Yes, I'm trying to participate in any presentation on the way.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that's great. Taking advantage of everything. So I actually saw, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'll start off with a little teaser question to get us warmed up. But I actually saw that you also have a podcast. Is that true?
Yes, it's on sustainable housing, sustainable living with heart and soul. And it's especially dedicated to people living in social housing.
Yeah.
And I want to fascinate them about sustainable living and saving money on the other hand, because that's one of the deficiencies they experience in daily life. And we take all kinds of issues on mobility, on sustainable food buying, on moving house in a sustainable way, reuse, upcycling, whatever. Yeah.
Cool.
And neighborhood. That's very important because everything which continues in the long run is based on a good neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, very true. I was just actually at the Lovable Neighborhoods Conference in London, and we spoke so much about this, these concepts of forming these communities around these neighborhoods. And so, yeah, very inspired by all of that talk. The podcast is in German, right?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. But we'll make sure to link it in the show notes so any of our lovely German speakers can also find it there. So, yeah, digging in a bit deeper to you and your work. So I was reading your bio and, you know, a bit of information on you, and it says you are passionate about encouraging people to turn to less resource consumption lifestyles. How are you encouraging people to do that? And are you having any luck?
I'm a former climate change researcher. Mm-hmm. And it made me quite sad that I started to study this in the 90s when it was not a topic yet. And emissions just go up and up and up and up. So something must have been wrong with the whole communication so far. So I try to make people change their habits through entertainment, through fun, through fascinating them.
Yeah.
And rather than telling them how bad it might come or that they have to reduce their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And yeah, it works quite well. Recently, I've been invited to a family telling me, we took part at your workshops and excursions to sustainable living, And now look at our furniture. When we moved, we didn't throw the old furniture away. We reused them and repainted them and used them in a different way. So we are saving resources. And in another situation, a woman told me she had psychological problems and moved into a new house and was offered an urban gardening plot. And she was, as usually, too afraid to start something. And then she met a neighbor in a workshop of mine who was cancer sick. And they both joined and decided to make a plot together. And now they are best friends. So it's a mixture of sustainable living and good neighborhood, which is the basis for a resource-friendly lifestyle.
Yeah, and you know, this concept of sharing resources, yes. Right? And that actually brings us closer to our neighbors and closer to our community. I find that really interesting. So is there a certain project that you've been working on or that you've worked on in the past that you can explain a bit about that you're passionate about?
Oh, there are many projects. I'm working parallel. I started now with something called Climate Saloon in Innsbruck. The last 2 years we refurbished the first park in Innsbruck towards a climate fit outdoor area. What does it mean, climate fit? This is improving on the green infrastructure, mm-hmm. implementing blue infrastructure so that the park is a kind of cool oasis for people during summer heat. Of course, we also increased the general, the experience in the park all over the year. And we closed down a road. We made another road changed it towards a bike lane. We increased the lawn size. So we reduced the amount of concrete.
Yeah.
And how should the city communicate that they are retrofitting parks and public spaces to the residents? So I thought, let's invite some clubs or initiatives to make small events in the Climate Saloon to tell people something about sustainable life. And when I had the first workshop where we gathered ideas, suddenly there came 20 clubs. And at the end, we have now the whole summer from May to August, about 40 events. Wow. On a small scale. I consider them as climate saloons where you have the possibilities to get in touch with people, where you have personal communication, everything from bicycle workshops, climate theater, reuse workshops, repair cafes, panel discussions about sustainable nutrition, regional and local food. And yeah, it's grown so big and it attracts thousands of people because it's not only those who participate at an event and telling their neighbors and their friends and relatives, but each initiative participating in this park as an event, they have to think in their organization, in their club, in their society, how they can implement a green event. So it's a multiplying effect, which it goes out of control in a positive way.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's really inspiring to hear. And so what I guess also I always want to ask, but what were the challenges, right? So every project has, it sounds wonderful, but of course there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes. What were the hurdles and how did you overcome them?
The biggest hurdle was I asked at the university, at the architecture faculty, if they want to build a stage mm-hmm. in the park. So 17 students used it as a bachelor project for 2 semesters to develop a stage made out of reuse material. So they had to ask where their houses turned down to get some material to build it up. And when it finally stood there, we had a discussion with the city authority, where I'm also part of the city. How can we ensure this? Is it a stage? And what? Then it needs a special insurance. And what's in the time between events when people sit on this stage, which is, it doesn't look like a normal stage. It's a very creative building. So is it then a public furniture, like a bench? It is too big and too special, too artistic. So we had real problems when we started the event series, the Climate Saloon. We had first to close the whole stage because the lawyers of the city, they couldn't agree on how to ensure this element in the public space. So now we had to post signs on it that you should not enter it, which is a very bad sign to the public. We had a chain locking one of the entrances, but you can climb on this stage everywhere. Now we agreed with the authorities that we can open it, and they have found some kind of insurance, but it's still very, very difficult. Not for this, the residents, they don't know what's behind the scenery, but I think I used 100, 200 mails and even more phone calls to find an arrangement. Yes, and this the day before the opening.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always these things that no one sees, right? And that's also one thing that I want to highlight when we speak to people like you, that there's a lot that goes behind the scenes. So we should all be understanding and open-minded to how things are developing and express our opinion, of course, about what you see, but also be mindful that there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. So I was going to ask you about the Climate Fit Park anyway, so I was very curious. So thanks for telling me about that. And so I also want to ask you, in your experience, so how long have you worked in kind of the citizen participation?
About 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. But earlier I worked for a real estate company, for a public real estate company, for social housing. And there I was the sustainability officer, and I was always involving tenants in various projects of neighborhood creation and team building in a way, and also getting them involved in why we refurbish their houses towards passive houses.
Yeah,
I was leading a project in Innsbruck of this real estate company called Symphonia, where we managed to retrofit buildings from the 1930s and 40s, that means residential houses and schools, to become passive houses. And what I considered as most important, you cannot implement any measures without involving the tenants or the pupils. So we had a lot of workshops also with pupils, explaining them why we suddenly refurbished their schools. Mm. Pupils from between 6 and 12 years old. So we had workshops where they could test different materials of insulation. I took a friend's dollhouse to one of the workshops. We had many stations where the children were going around testing things to show them where we should insulate houses on the roof, the walls. Yes, one day I even brought snow in May. I had to go very high up, I think at 3 or 4 in the morning, to pick up some snow left in the mountain to bring to one of the workshops, and letting children dig different types of insulation or different types of material into this pot of snow and measure temperature. Just to see how much insulation it's needed to keep things warm. And we did a lot of things just to let them know why it is rational to retrofit their building. And it was so nice. One day I went through a part of the city, and a Turkish boy came to me and had his mom on his hand and said, "Mom, this is our teacher. This is our teacher. She told me our windows are too poor." Because I showed them also, my colleague showed them also windows, which are with three layers of glass. And they also had some shadows going down, I don't use to call this
the shades
with PV, with photovoltaic. So he was very exciting to tell his mom he learned something. And in their home, they had still the old windows. So that's something which makes me very happy that it goes further away, not only to the pupils, but also to their families.
That's a wonderful story. Thanks for sharing. And so what do you think is the key really to citizen participation, bringing them snow in May? What's the key really to citizen participation?
You need, in order to transform the society towards a less resource consuming society, you need all kinds of senses. I apply Montessori pedagogy. Mm-hmm. To knowledge transfer. As I worked many years in science, as a climate scientist, I see the importance how to communicate what I know to a level fitting, not only to a level, but also to a situation where people are open-minded. Like, for example, I have another project called a driving license for sustainable housing. Mm-hmm. So before people get the key to a new apartment, social housing in the city. About half a year before, I start with workshops, excursions, city walks with the future tenants and teach them all about sustainable housing. Like, for example, about 5 years, 5 months ahead, they must make a decision about what kind of kitchen they have to buy. So we discuss what dishwasher, what refrigerator they should buy, if they have to buy a new one, after what criteria they should go ahead in the shop. Is it the cheapest one? In most cases, yes. And then I tell them, how long do you think such a machinery lasts? A fridge maybe gets broken after 3 years, right after the guarantee time. And then you have all the hassles of removing this old fridge, getting a new one, bringing it up to the third floor, installing it. Why don't you buy one which can be repaired? And why don't you buy one which over the lifetime has less energy energy consumption? So at the end, it will be cheaper to buy a good, high quality equipment for your apartment rather than buying cheap in the beginning and being annoyed a short time afterwards. And all these workshops, they also make people think about their new neighbors. So they know each other already a long time before they move into the new house. And for example, we make discovery walks around the future neighborhood, showing them making it tasty for them to use the bike or walk rather than using the car for going to shops. And I'm sometimes surprised when we do such walks in existing neighborhood, how little people actually know their 15 minutes neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and we bring them to a waste site to talk about garbage separation, about what they can do to reduce the amount of waste in a household, which is already very big when they move in. All the package, all the cartoons,
all the packaging.
The packages.
Yeah,
yes.
Packages.
Sorry about my English.
No, please. It's excellent.
So, yes, these workshops, they make people feeling suddenly important. And they learn something many, many years after school. Recently, I had an old man, a Turkish man, sitting in my workshop, and I thought he wouldn't understand anything because of language barriers. And after the workshop, he came to me and said, next workshop, I bring my 3 sons. One of them is even my lawyer. They must see the waste site. I think that's so exciting. And then they learn so much about their life. And it made me feeling happy because I thought he wouldn't grasp anything I tell him about energy. And suddenly, yes, it made something in his mind thinking about resource consumption.
Wow, that's really inspiring. So, yeah, I guess my question now is, you seem very optimistic about behavior change, in that you feel like people are open and willing to change. And of course, I also believe that, but I've also seen the other side, right, where it's pulling and pushing people maybe a bit to not take a car or something along those lines. Do you think, just to play a bit of devil's advocate, of course, so do you think it's a losing battle to convince people to use less resources, or do you truly feel very optimistic about it?
It's a necessary battle.
Yeah.
But last week before the conference, I thought, I should buy a new trouser. And someone sent me to I thought it was a shop, but it was an outlet center. And I had to queue about 15 minutes to find a parking square. And then I just left and I didn't buy anything. And I wondered, there were thousands of people on a weekend to go to an outlet shop just buying things. Yeah. And I felt so sick. And I was thinking, this is a different class of people, actually, than I usually address with my workshops. I work with social clients, with people in public residential homes. So how can I address the middle class? I mean, not the bobo, the ones educated, who want everything to do right, like sending their children to Montessori school, eating vegan. And at the other side, buying a new iPhone every half year and traveling to Thailand or wherever. So this controversial lifestyle. But how to address the middle class who don't want to give up their big SUVs?
Yeah.
This is a hard battle, but usually everybody has one entrance window where I could start a discussion. And such a discussion I had recently. A woman telling me, why do you always talk about mobility other ways than using a car? I love my car. I love my SUV and I don't want to give up. And I had her in a city walk showing the neighborhood. And then she told me, I have only one hobby and it's gardening. And I told her, well, already in the neighborhood, two streets away from your home, there you have a nice urban gardening. But there are no parking squares, I said. And then she said, do you really think I have to take a car when I go gardening? That's a contradiction. I would cycle, of course. And suddenly I had her into thinking about cycling around in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But the entrance window was the gardening project. So, and I believe that everyone has such an entrance, but you just have to take time to find it. And that causes, of course, a lot of convincing, a lot of talking, listening, observing until you find the right moment or the right issue.
Yeah, that's a really good thought. And so I guess you touched on this kind of economic lens as well. So I'm wondering, you touched on this these different classes, and I think that this is such an economic issue as well. So do you think everyone, I guess, can afford to use less resources? Can people, is it the upper class that you think is the main target? So far, you've mostly been talking about the lower class and middle class. So what views do you have there?
I think if you look at the income distribution of various countries and compare it with the resource use, there's, of course, the highest amount of resource, the highest footprint on those having a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. And those are the people that might be also hardest to convince, right?
Yeah. But still, if you go to a harbor in Holland and you look how many containers of goods are transported around the world with things actually we don't need, then it's actually the big mass of people causing also the big bulk of emissions. So you have to address all sides.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So do you have any advice for councils or people trying to do something similar to you that want to engage more, that want to convince people more of these, of using less resources? What's your one piece of advice you would give?
Estate companies and property managers, when they build houses or when they get new tenants to their existing houses, this driving license for sustainable living is a kind of built environment often gets these medals, bronze, silver, gold, when they are very high energy efficient built. And I focus on a similar, how do you call it, certification of residents. So a property manager should also get a certificate how much effort they put into creating awareness among their tenants or among their residents in sustainable living. I would have got about 100,000 euro this week to perform such a project through whole Austria together with other counties. But the politicians in my town, they refused that I take on this money because we have a green mayor in our town and they are envious if he would have a successful project. So while the others are allowed to continue with the project they developed, I have to be, I can't participate. So it's very, very sad, making me quite
frustrating. With that note, I would like to move on to just a little segment. It's a new segment, actually, and it's called Inspire Us.
Inspire us just a little bit with a story, a quote, or anything that has inspired you recently.
You mean of another person?
Anything you'd like, anything that has inspired you.
The older you get, the crazier you can become because you have nothing to lose. So I'm experimenting all the time. And if not everything works out, but I have nothing to lose.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you so much. And this is a question now that I ask every single guest because it's so interesting to see how people answer it from different perspectives. And it's the question, what is a smart city to you?
A city can never be smart. It's only the people being smart.
Good, good answer. And very to the point. I love it. So yeah, with that, I won't take up too much more of your time. I will let you get to your tea and to the really interesting dialogue and conversations of this. But I just want to thank you, a huge thank you to you for taking the time, especially first thing in the morning today, after a long night last night, exploring and learning. So I really appreciate your insights and really look forward to hearing more about your work in the future too. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
And to all of our listeners, don't forget you can always create a free account on babel-smartcities.eu. to find out more about smart city projects, solutions, and implementations. Thank you all for listening. I'll see you at the next stop on the journey to a better urban life.